How's that for a natural white? Whoosh, and messing with your iris. Hi, everybody. I'm Paul Yeager. This is the MTOM podcast, and this is my friend Metal Sign. And you can get Metal Sign by going to markettomarket.org/donate. Make a contribution to help this program, and then we have awesome thank you gifts like this. Or I got to tell you, there's a big run on these really cool phone stands for the side of your computer. Producer John Torpy's like, why did you not tell me these are super cool? I'm like, well, you know, we like to keep things in suspense. And one thing we're not keeping in suspense today is our guest on the podcast. It's John Anderson, and he is head of the Agricultural Economics and Agribusiness Department at the University of Arkansas. He's also a return guest on the M2M podcast. We talked to him in April of 2020. Remember that time in our lives? Well, he does, and it's his job to study things like that. We get into some very good discussion about supply lines, supply chains, what you've noticed when you've gone shopping, whether it be in retail or grocery or maybe for camping gear. For some reason, I was obsessed with camping gear in this episode. We're also going to talk about food service versus the grocery store industry. So this is a discussion that you have seen part of it already on the Market to Market TV show, but this is the full version of that interview where we start with John in Arkansas and pick up where we left off last time and where he was located versus where he's located now. All right, you've almost got the springtime behind you. You got leaves almost on the trees down there yet?
They're starting to come out right now, so we're in the almost ideal time of year in the Ozarks when the red bud has bloomed and the dogwood is just starting to open up, and we'll have a week or two of beautiful scenery with that, and then the leaves will fully come on and we'll pretty much be into to full blast spring at that point. But when the red bud and dogwood come on, this is the best place in the world to be.
Well, better than your home. The last time we talked, you were at your house. You were back on campus. You were just telling me a moment ago, fairly early. What's a better view, your home or your office?
Well, that sounds like a loaded question. I have a good view both places. I'll say I like the company at home, certainly, but it's easier to get things done in the office.
So you're back in... I got to say, John, I have thought of you almost every Saturday morning when I've gone to the grocery store, and I've approached – I've told the story of our previous discussion several times, and I've approached it from as close to a scientific way as I can going through the grocery store to look what has come and been there and what's gone and what's returned.
Yep.
How do you do that every week? I mean, that's just that's a hassle.
Well, it's a. I think it's a little bit of a compulsion. I don't know that it's necessarily a healthy thing.
How long were things disrupted in Arkansas last year?
You know, I was thinking about this earlier as I was preparing for this call. You know, last time we talked, you're right, I was kind of sitting in the basement taking toilet paper inventory like everybody else. And we thought that things were fairly disrupted at that point. And they were. They actually got quite a bit worse, I think, after we talked, because that's when we started to have, you know, the effects of actual health problems on workers in meatpacking plants and all that sort of stuff kicked off later. And disrupted things even further. And that was a pretty big deal for us because obviously, you know, we're kind of the epicenter of the poultry industry in a lot of respects, or one of two or three major epicenters of the poultry industry. And so that was fairly disruptive. That lasted through most of April, if I recall. I mean, 2020 is kind of a blur really, but by the time we got to about the end of April, I think we had turned a corner. Things had stabilized. You know, we weren't seeing as much in the way of empty shelves. You know, the food service sector had kind of figured out how to operate. They certainly weren't back to normal. They're still not back to normal. A lot of fast food places around where, you know, it's still drive-through only, you know, no dining room service, that kind of thing. So I wouldn't say we're back to normal, but places kind of figured out how to operate under the constraints that COVID forced on them. And, you know, things operated reasonably smoothly after about late April.
And that's, I think, a common thing, because I look at the video that we shot, and it was kind of done with all the close signs on everything by the end of April. We get to May, and it gets warmer, and everybody wanted to get outside. We had numbers go down. There were some pivots back, because the calendar was back on our side. I think we talked about how the dairy industry was impacted with logistics, like everything was. The big dairies of the world can handle more consumer milk in June and to an extent May. So it just took a while. What was the biggest hurdle when it came to logistics of food?
You know, there are going to be millions of pages written about that, Paul, and they're still being written as we speak. But I think, you know, as I look at what really is still a preliminary view of what happened when you get right down to it. I mean, we feel like we're a year through this thing, that we've got a handle on it. But the more in-depth evaluation of this situation is in my mind still in its preliminary stages. But I think what we're going to see is the big disruption was the separate optimization that we had for our food service versus our grocery retail supply chains. And that is a very efficient system. It's still an efficient system. It has a lot to recommend it, but in the very specific circumstances of COVID, it became a liability, at least for a time. And honestly, I think having to redirect that, you mentioned dairy, right? Having a fluid milk processing facility set up to only produce half pint cartons was disastrous in COVID, right? Because all the schools were closed and nobody wanted half pint cartons, right? But what do you do with crates full of half pint cartons when schools are closed? You know, cheese facilities that were set up to do 40 pound blocks of cheese and only 40 pound blocks of cheese when all the retail grocery store wanted, you know, 1 pound blocks of cheese. I mean, those were the kind of things that really were disruptive. And even toilet paper, I joked about toilet paper a second ago, but having paper mills that were set up to produce, you know, huge rolls of toilet paper to go in commercial facilities versus regular rolls of toilet paper like you use at home, that was disruptive in the specific circumstances of COVID. And I think there were a lot of other things that were happening, obviously, having to deal with social distancing in a physical plant, right, where you're doing some kind of processing or some kind of production operation. That was disruptive too. So there were lots of things that contributed, but I think we were all caught a little bit flat-footed by how much difference it made that we basically had two parallel supply chains, and one of those chains basically lost its market overnight.
Okay, you mentioned a couple of things that I think, let's see if I'm paying attention right in class. you're mentioning pivots in production.
Yes.
That's one thing that happened right away. But now we've come to the point where the pivots happened, and all of a sudden the hose that we used to have coming in as the supply has been disrupted in many things. Like somebody had storage of certain items, and now all of a sudden it's gone. Whether that's food, whether that's making camping gear, or, you know, whatever the thing is. How have those supply lines been able to weather, and why have supply lines become, or why are they still a story?
Well, I think they're a story because we're still trying to figure out now what optimum looks like, right? What is optimal now in a post-COVID world? We had an optimal arrangement pre-COVID, hyper efficient, you know, everything just in time, very lean operations, really throughout the supply chain, a minimal number of suppliers because the fewer people you got to deal with, the better. So very little redundancy in those systems. And so we had a system that was optimal for the pre-COVID world. And I'm not prepared to say that it's not optimal now. It certainly wasn't optimal in 2020, but there are a lot of advantages to that kind of system. It's a very low cost system. It's very efficient. It drives down costs throughout the system. There's a reason that we had that system, right? And those reasons haven't gone away. We're just having to change our calculation a little bit. How much do we need to change our calculation based on the possibility of something like COVID? And so why that's still a story is I don't think that's an easy question to answer. How much do we need to recalibrate based on the experience of COVID? And I think reasonable people can really disagree on that. I don't think it would be unreasonable for somebody to say, you know, we don't need to change at all. This was a black swan event. I mean, let's don't organize our whole system around a black swan. Let's find ways of being prepared to mitigate that risk, but keep the advantages of these low cost efficient systems. Let's don't change anything. I'm not saying that's my answer, but I don't think that's a crazy answer. And you have people on the other side who say, no, COVID showed that this is a disaster, that the potential costs of this and the disruptions are too great a burden to bear. And they affect too many people in too many negative ways. So let's completely change these supply systems. Let's get shorter supply chains. Let's get redundancy built in our system. Let's get spare capacity online so that we're not running so lean all the time. So, and, you know, everywhere in between those points is a possible place for us to operate these systems. And so I think the reason that we're going to be focused on this for a while is I don't think we know yet. Like I said, I think in terms of deep understanding of what we've been through, we're still in a pretty preliminary stage. And where exactly we'll settle out on what is the right way to operate a supply chain for the dairy sector, the meat sector, the lumber sector, the paper sector, the camping supply sector, right now, that's an open question, I think, to a lot of folks, to a lot of decision makers who are operating in those spaces.
I think if I look at my notes, efficiency translates in the factory world to making money. That's why we have efficiencies.
That's right.
And there could be fewer companies making money because efficiencies are what help them become profitable.
That's right. Efficiencies are obviously make a contribution to the bottom line. Efficiency means lower cost. Lower cost means more money. Now, more money might mean more profit to the companies operating in that supply chain. Lower cost might also mean a lower retail price to the consumers who are buying those goods. And I don't hear, and again, I lean more toward thinking that we're probably going to go back to something that looks a whole lot like what we had pre-COVID. Probably won't be exactly like it. I think that there'll be a lot more work to understand the reliability of upstream suppliers, for instance, and the vulnerability of downstream markets. I think we'll do a lot more investment in understanding our supply chains and having kind of plan B or C or D in place. But I think plan A is going to look a lot like what we had pre-COVID, and it is because efficiency is so powerful. We understand this in agriculture, right? I mean, we're a hyper-efficient industry. We understand economies of scale. We understand the value of technology to drive costs down. And that efficiency, again, it keeps you in business and it keeps your end product prices down. Consumers are not clamoring for higher prices, and they never will.
No, but we saw higher prices in some things. Others were kept in check because there wasn't, I mean, simple supply demand would say, if I'll go back to my camping gear, if I had a run on tents, if I am a seller of tents, I should raise my price. But you're going to get eviscerated on the social media side of things of, look at them, they're taking advantage of all of the, you know, but that's simple supply and demand economics there. And some of those had to have been thrown out the window.
Yeah, I think they were. And again, I think there will be more of an effort to have a more resilient system. How do we make the system more resilient without raising costs? And I'm not saying this is the right answer, but lower cost is a powerful inducement. And I think we'll lean more toward recapturing those efficiencies. But we're going to try to do that in ways that preserve resilience as much as possible. And I'm not sure exactly what that'll look like, but that's the game that supply chain managers are trying to play now. And I think you bring up a good example, Paul. And I think even more to the point of, hey, everybody's out of camping gear. I've got camping gear. I'm going to raise the price. Really what was frustrating, I think, to a lot of managers was everybody's out of camping gear, including me, and demand is through the roof, and I've got nothing to sell. I'll give you a little anecdote. My wife and I bought a used vehicle during the pandemic, and she wanted an aftermarket screen with backup camera. And so I went to the car audio place that carries that kind of thing, and this was probably in, I don't know, July. I can't remember exactly when it was, but I go in, and the place was absolutely cleaned out. And I was talking to the managers. I'm like, I'm looking for an aftermarket screen. He said, man, that comes from China. He said, I haven't been able to get anything. He said, I'm sold out and I'm back ordered for 6 months. I don't know when I'll have inventory again. And so, and there are people like me coming in saying, I need a radio. I need speakers. I need a backup camera. And he had almost nothing on the shelves and was like, I don't know when I'll be able to backfill because the supply chains are so disrupted. So that was the real frustration. And that was, I think what was probably more common than price gouging was just nobody had anything to sell. And that's what a manager really wants to avoid, right? I mean, You've got people with the stimulus check burning a hole in their pocket and they want to buy something and you're out because your supply chain wasn't resilient.
I can't tell you how many times on the show we've had the discussion of, well, once this consumer gets back out and starts buying what are they going to buy? Because there's right. some products that aren't available.
Yeah.
You bring up C word, China. That is, I believe, both an upstream and a downstream for the American business sector. We need certain materials from them. We hope to sell the thing we've made or the thing we've put together somewhere else and ship to China. How much was that backlog trade war related versus COVID related?
You know, I don't know. I think by the time we got to summer, most of it was COVID related. I think we probably didn't start out on as good a footing as maybe we could have because of the trade disruptions that had already been taking place. I think by the time we got to summer, it really was a lot was COVID related because their production systems had been dramatically disrupted by COVID. The shipping systems had been dramatically disrupted by COVID. And so I think we probably started not from an ideal position, but I think by the time we got to summer, most of the problems were COVID problems.
Okay. All right. I want to get to the two areas kind of in your backyard. We didn't get into this the last time, and I wanted to, about Walmart. Do you think Walmart comes out? Did this expose anything to the large retail box store, the whole COVID thing, did it expose vulnerabilities or did it allow them to thrive and show their business model works?
You know, I think it was probably some of both. I think early on, it exposed some vulnerabilities because they had empty store shelves like everybody else. They had consumers who were afraid to get out. I mean, this wasn't just an issue of supply chains being disrupted, consumer behavior changed, right? Because think back to March when we really didn't know how this thing was going to play out. A lot of people didn't want to get out. They didn't want to expose themselves. They changed their behavior pretty dramatically in ways that were pretty negative for anything that required in-person interface, right? So that was a vulnerability. And so I think early on it did expose some vulnerability. Like, am I going to order my dish soap from Amazon, or am I going to go to Walmart and pick it up? Well, early on in the pandemic, I think the more touchless model had the advantage there. I think what we saw the large retailers do was adapt pretty quickly to that environment. You know, I was in Sam's this weekend, and it seemed like half of the front of the store was piled up with pickup orders. This is this huge selection, this huge area where they've got carts full of stuff that people are coming to pick up. You know, they added all kinds of capacity, and I was pretty amazed actually around here. And again, you know, we're right in Walmart's backyard, right? So they're pretty nimble here for sure. The way they changed facilities, the way they changed staffing, the way they changed store operations to accommodate pickup and delivery was pretty remarkable, I thought, because that had not been their model. I mean, it had been available in some places, maybe it had been available in everywhere, but was the uptake on it had been pretty low from what I could tell, but that really took off. And so we saw a lot of stores doing that, not just Walmart, you know, all the local grocery stores. Even I live out of town in a very small town with one grocery store, and that grocery store is doing a booming pickup business. Not somewhere you'd really expect to see that kind of thing. So I think it did both, Paul. I think it did expose some vulnerabilities early on. But, you know, like the saying goes, right, every dark cloud has got a silver lining. I think a lot of these places found the opportunity in that vulnerability and adapted fairly quickly.
John, I've read a lot about one of the other companies based in your state, Tyson. You know, they took a hit probably in April, May into June at facilities where you're working neck to neck, elbow to elbow with somebody else, and it was hard to adjust those lines. We saw chain speeds adjust. We saw backups of animals, maybe not necessarily in the poultry business as much as it was in hogs and cattle, but it was a major thing in the food production. However, I'm pretty sure I can get almost any cut of meat I need in my store right now.
Yeah, that's another thing. I mean, I think the pandemic did expose some vulnerability. I think the companies, by and large, did. I was shocked at how good a job they did adapting and how quickly they adapted and got product back into the market. And I would say, I think if you look at the numbers objectively, and I've spent a lot of time actually looking at poultry and pork and beef, all three took a major hit. But if you just look at the decline in production that happened in that April, May timeframe, it was much greater in beef and pork than it was in poultry. And I think it has a lot to do with the nature of the production systems, really, and to some extent how the plants are set up. But the chicken sector I think it probably started to take the disruption first, but got through it with a much lower total impact and got through it quicker than hogs and cattle. Hogs and cattle had some big, if you look at the decline in weekly production in pork and beef, it was dramatic there in April. And it was exactly what you're talking about. How do we keep managing these plants in the face of COVID? And, it took a solid month or 6 weeks to work that out. And I don't want to make it sound like it's totally over and everything's back to normal. I mean, these plants are continuing to change how they do business to be able to continue to operate. But I was actually pleasantly surprised at how successful they were. You know, you got to think back. I think it was in April that Tyson ran a full page ad in the Washington Post and the New York Times and said the food supply chain is breaking. Now, that's a pretty dramatic statement. I mean, that gets people's attention. And in the midst of that situation, as I was looking at those weekly production numbers, I don't think that was a far-fetched thing to say. Yeah, it was breaking. That, you know, how they adapted to that I think that was a big challenge. And, I don't know all the ins and outs of what they had to do in these plants, but that they were able to recover production as quickly as they did was pretty stunning, I thought.
Is it going to be a long-term answer? Or is this only a short-term answer that the meat production companies are doing?
You know, I think it's – I don't know, Paul. That's a good question. I don't think, you know, unless we saw that system tested again, I don't know that we would have the answer to that. You know, if we had a resurgence of COVID, could they maintain? I think they could certainly do a better job than they did the first time, but it would still be disruptive. I mean, part of what's happened is that, now with the vaccine going out, I think we've got, COVID kind of went through the plants, honestly. And, they took that hit and, mitigated the best they could. But at some point, you know, if a lot of your workers have already been exposed and gotten over it and are back to work, then the worst of the problem is over. And I think some of that was at work. Some of this was a herd immunity issue. If we had a different deal, if we had a new strain or heaven forbid, another disease that tested us again, how bad would the hit be? I couldn't answer that. It would be a significant disruption, but I don't think it would be as bad as COVID was, because we learned a lot from that episode. We learned how we can space people out. We learned how we can adjust production schedules. We learned how we can move from one plant to another more fluidly. I mean, we learned a lot of things. Like we put a lot of physical barriers in place to actually separate workstations that otherwise were side by side. So there's just a lot of things that were done that I think would give us some enduring benefits, but I would hesitate to say, hey, it wouldn't be any big deal. It wouldn't be any effect. Yeah, it would be some effect, but I don't think it would be nearly as dramatic as what we saw in April.
Well, which textbook got ripped up the most in the last year. The supply side or the supply management textbook, the logistics textbook, they're kind of the same in a way. Somebody that studies supply chains. I mean, whose textbook is going to be in 5 years completely different than it was before?
So I think the supply chain folks are going to be rethinking a lot of things. And, you know, we've talked about this already. I don't know ultimately how significant the changes will be, but I think that we'll certainly see a lot more about evaluating risks and understanding vulnerabilities, both upstream and downstream. You know, one thing that I've been looking at over the last few months is there's a ton of academic work out there on networks and network failure. And a lot of this literature relates to, you know, communications networks. You know, how do you avoid a failure of a communications network? You know, how do you make your key points in that network stronger, more resilient, those kind of things. And a lot of that kind of thinking is going to be applied to supply chains. And that's already happened. That's really nothing new. But I think that we're going to look at that in greater depth, in greater detail. We're going to look at that more creatively. And the issue of managing risk within a supply chain is going to be, I don't know that they'll rip the textbook up, but they will at least add a couple of chapters.
Big time. One of the things that some of my friends in North Dakota have told me is their thinking has been over the years, we're miles from nowhere, or we're miles from anywhere. We have to do everything ourselves. Was there a region of the country that survived better or was able to withstand a lot of the challenges better because they had access to water and food and whatever product they needed? Was there a part of the United States that maybe was a little less impacted when it comes to supply?
You know, I don't know. That's a good question. And that's a big topic of conversation right now. You know, the framing that you will see is shorter supply chains. Do we have places? What you're asking is, do we have places in the country that had shorter supply chains for some of these key products, and so they were less susceptible to disruption? I'm sure that's probably true. I think across the board, you know, obviously there are some places that did better than others. I'm tremendously grateful that I'm living in Northwest Arkansas and not New York City through the COVID episode. So certainly some places fared better than others. Now, in terms kind of across the board related specifically to the food supply chains, you know, I don't know. I think what I suspect you would see is that there are trade-offs, and different places have made those trade-offs differently. If you've got a technologically sophisticated, a very lean, very connected supply chain that's very efficient, that gives you great cost advantages in normal times. If you've got those more localized, shorter, maybe redundant systems, they really pay off in a time like COVID, but it's more overhead to cover in the normal time. So, you know, I think different people will make that trade-off differently. Different regions, different state and local and regional governments might make those trade-offs differently. But there is definitely a trade-off, right? If you've got extra capacity, if you've got a less efficient system that maybe is a little harder against outside disruptions, that's a great thing when those disruptions come, but you're paying for that all the time, right? And maybe it's worth it to maintain that, but that should be a conscious decision. I mean, we think we really need to evaluate those trade-offs systematically to decide, again, in a particular place, what do people want?
Well, they want to be able to eat. And
that's definitely true.
I mean, you look at the seed catalogs and the places that are providing seed, they're running late on supply because people are determining they're going to raise their own food this year because they don't want to put it in the hand of somebody else. All right, last thing, John. Two things. There's two things I want to get to real quick. Is it going to make more America first? Are we going to bring some of the things back that we sent out overseas and offshore for a cost-saving measure? bring it back that we can produce here. I mean, that was the common thing for a while with global trade. We import from here. We send work here, and we put a factory there. America First, it was a campaign slogan, as a matter of fact, in the presidential race.
I think that's a great question, and I don't know the answer, Paul. I do think, as I said, I mean, in my career working within agriculture, I can think of very few instances where lower costs haven't carried the day. And it's hard for me to believe that's not the case now. Maybe it's not. Maybe COVID did change things dramatically enough that people are going to say, you know what, I don't care if it costs more. I don't want to be reliant on somebody else for this. And we're gonna put the barriers in place, or we're going to voluntarily commit to support this. But in some way, we're gonna take the higher cost to make sure that we've got this product, whatever it is. It's toilet paper. To make sure I never run out of toilet paper again, I'm willing to spend more money. That would be a big change, honestly, over anything I've ever seen in my career working in commercial agriculture, right? Because typically what we've seen is everybody's for it until it costs another half a cent, and then they're not for it. I'm not convinced yet that COVID has changed that mentality. I mean, and maybe that's a blind spot just based on my own experience, but in my experience, low cost has always won. And I won't be shocked if low cost doesn't win here. And, you know, we talk about, again, let's do everything we can to make this system more resilient, but let's don't compromise on the efficiency of the system. I'll be shocked if that's not where we end up, to be honest with you, Paul, because that low cost is such a powerful force in the market. That comes with a vulnerability. And I think we'll look for other ways to mitigate that vulnerability, but I do think efficiency is very hard to resist.
And we might pivot for just a little while. We might put up with a little higher cost, and then somebody is going to go and say, forget it. I'm going low cost. I'm undercutting everybody else, and all of a sudden we're back to where we were before.
And that has played out in the past, and I wouldn't be shocked. I mean, you mentioned Walmart. I remember, you know, some 15 years ago, Walmart had a big push on American made, and then realized that their costs were higher, and they pivoted from that to the lowest price every day. And there was a reason for that, right? Efficiency has won in our market over and over again. And again, COVID may have changed that, but I've kind of got a Missouri attitude on that. You're going to have to show me. I'm going to have to see it happen.
Last thing, when you're allowed to go back out and you're asked to go back out and speak, and you're going to have to make a paper presentation, and you're like, all right, John, we want you to speak at our conference. What's the title of your speech and what's the subject matter?
Well, that's a good question. I'm actually working on a paper right now. I've been asked to go to an animal science meeting in Louisville to talk about supply chain disruptions. And I'm going to talk about a lot of what we just talked about here. It's going to be supply chain management in a post-COVID world. And we'll talk about some of these issues and trade-offs between efficiency and resilience and redundancy and those sort of things, because that really is what's on people's mind right now.
Well, maybe we've got the Cliff Notes version here. We appreciate that.
Absolutely.
All right, John Anderson, thank you so much for your time. Always good to talk.
Yep. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you for your continued support of the program. My thanks to John Anderson from the University of Arkansas. If you have any feedback for me, paul.yeager@iowapbs.org. We will see you next time here on the MTOM podcast.